This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
On today's show, we are going to get into something that we forecast a few weeks ago, so this has been in the works for a while. There are a number of topics, none of them particularly new, but which have heated up in the last couple of weeks and months around the general topic of women in the professional kitchen, women chefs and cooks, something that we felt we wanted to get into in detail and we wanted to devote an entire show to specifically, and these are just three of many things we could talk about, but we have limited time. Most recently, there was a huge discrepancy in the number of women versus men in the semifinalist list for the James Beard Foundation Awards. Helen Rosner at Eater did a piece when that list came out. In certain categories, I guess maybe those discrepancies are less so in the actual finalist nominee list, but nevertheless. And that really, we think, it's just the most recent example of certain things that have been going on in this industry for a long time. Certain awards that identify best women chef as a category, and things like this that seem kind of hopelessly out of date. Maternity leave in the pro kitchen also has come up in a big way. There are two articles in the last year. Andrea Strong did one last summer, and more recently, Amanda Clute did a piece at Eater that got a lot of traction in the industry, and people are still talking about those pieces. And then there was, of course, a recent lawsuit filed against Chef Michael Carello in California that put the subject of sexual harassment front and center again in a big way. So we wanted to talk about that. We have some terrific guests we'll introduce in just a second. And I've said this many times. It's almost become sort of a catchphrase for me, but I say it whenever we do these, whenever we get into this topic, is that I'm always loath to bring it up, and it's always a bit of an uncomfortable thing for me to ask guests or people I might interview for articles to talk about subjects like this. This came up recently when I interviewed Emma for my blog, Tokeland. It's always uncomfortable for me to put people in the position of representing, you know, their gender or representing their ethnicity. Or I always say the same thing. I don't feel like anyone gets into this business to become a woman chef. You get into this business to become a chef. So I'm especially grateful to those of us who are with us today. And with that, I'd like to introduce, we have with us Karen Palmer, the executive editor of Tasting Table. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Emma Benson, executive chef of Aquavit in New York City.
Hi. Thank you.
Nice. Alina Martel, pastry chef of I Fiori in Vaucluse in New York City.
Good morning.
And I have to say, I didn't know this. We hadn't seen each other in a while, but when I got in touch, you said I'm a perfect candidate for this show. Are you 7 months expecting?
Yeah, you lucked out. I am in my third trimester already. So, you picked the right person.
Right on the money. Okay. We also are thrilled to have legendary chef Cindy Paulson of Mustard's Grill and Cindy's Backstreet Kitchen in St. Helena. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, everyone.
We have weather comparable to your weather today. So we're not
good. I'm glad.
Yeah, we're not as sad as we sometimes are. We talk to people from California. also, we are thrilled to be joined. You know, Jimmy and I put off some of these topics for a while because we thought, you know, how do two guys really moderate a show on this topic? We're probably not the best candidates for that. Had a couple of conversations with Heritage Radio Network's executive director, Aaron Fairbanks, who is also a former cooked at Gramercy Tavern and before that at Savoy in New York. And Aaron has graciously accepted our invitation to come on the show today and co-host with us and help drive this discussion. So good morning, Aaron.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. So with that, Aaron, I think I'm going to turn it over to you and let you start us on our way here.
Awesome. Well, I think we're going to kick it off talking a little bit about the importance of awards and award systems and infrastructure in foods for chefs, for restaurants, for beverage professionals. You know, the interesting thing to me is you look at the makeup of you know, the selection committees for the James Beard Food Awards or for Food and Wine. And it's not like we're looking out on a landscape of all men. There are definitely plenty of like women taking part in that selection criteria. And I guess I want to start with you, Karen. When you're, you know, when you're thinking about being intentional about bringing in multiple voices and in looking at diversity, I mean, for your work at Tasting Table, how do you think, like, also a very like female heavy organization, how do those like kind of gaps happen? Why are we getting like an awards selection that looks so different than the makeup if we can't blame the people selecting?
Right. Well, I think there are a couple things at play here. You know, obviously, even when we're talking about people to cover at Tasting Table, like you said, we try to be as inclusive as possible and cover, you know, not just the big names, the male chefs and restaurant owners, but, you know, get different genders, ethnicities, geography, you know, just try to cover everybody. But I do think it stems a lot from, you know, a lot of these larger restaurant groups are owned by men and they have the PR dollars, and that kind of, you know, drives the conversation of what people are talking about, not only in the media, but then, you know, it trickles down into where are these judges visiting for when, you know, when they're evaluating restaurants for awards. It all kind of, you know, it's kind of a vicious cycle.
A big part of the, like, the infrastructure.
Exactly.
I wonder, you know, Emma, can you maybe talk a little bit about, from like a chef's perspective, if you're like, man, we're going to go after a James Beard Award, or we're going to go after a, you know, Rising Chef. Is that a thing that comes up in your discussions when you're thinking about the restaurant and like your role in kind of putting yourself out there?
I think from my point of view, it's always an honor to get all these awards and nominations. But for me, and I don't know other, but I never got into this business to win awards. I got in the business to cook and make people happy of what I'm making for them. So that is not anything that I'm really like striving for personally. I know it's really good for the restaurant and it's good for the business, and it's amazing to get it, but it's not my number one priority in life. It's so, I guess maybe I'm not pushing that as hard as other people might do.
Sure. I wonder, Cindy, if you can talk a little bit about, you know, what would your advice be to someone who is an up-and-coming chef? How important, how relevant are these types of things to go after? What's your experience been? What have you seen?
Well, my experience has always been the harder you work and the better you do and the better you are at your craft, the more things will come your way. You're not going to be able to say, I want to be a James Beard award-winning chef. You need to say, I want to be a really great chef and do a really good job and be very professional and really know my trade and really be consistent, and it'll come to you then. It's not like you go after it. It comes to you if you do a good job. How I've always felt. And I think they're more of a fun thing to us. I mean, when we get nominated, we just get excited, and it's goofy, and it's like, wow, somebody noticed us way out here in California. So, you know, it's kind of a fun thing versus a motivator.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised to, you know, so it's a little bit of like, if you build it, they will come. I'm going to look back at you, Karen. I mean, I know for like us sitting here at radio, like, yes, we're like, our hosts are out there and they're meeting people and they're eating in restaurants and they're talking to, but a lot of what comes across our desk is the pitches and the pushes and the pulls that we get. And so how do you, in the space of media, find people who aren't putting themselves in front of you?
Right.
They're just cooking. They're just making great food.
I mean, we try to search out those people as much as possible. Actually, last year at the end of the year, Tasting Table did a big roundup of chefs who had like had a big year, and we tried specifically not to just focus on, you know, the David Changs and Mario Batalis of the world, and try to find the people behind those people who maybe, you know, are working for their groups and doing interesting things. And it really just has to do with our editors being out and about and trying to search out those stories, because same thing. I mean, we get pitches and, you know, PR folks coming to us all the time, but you just kind of have to broaden your net a little bit.
The exercise discipline, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, work a little. I think I work a little harder.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't like to talk about it. I used to be a publicist. That's how I first got around food. And I remember in all of our, when we would pitch a new client, you know, one of the things in the pitch was for hiring an agency, you know, journalists come to us because it makes their job easier, right? And I think that's even become more the case because at that time, there weren't blogs that needed to be fed, you know, hourly or several times a day.
Right.
So it was harder for journalists to keep pace. I'd love to go back to the question, though, that Aaron asked up front about, and then you were talking about it, but I'm just wondering, when you do set out to, you know, like that list that you all did.
Sure.
Late in the year, is there a conscious effort to keep to be diverse? Is that something that is explicitly, is that a, not maybe a mission, I hate that word, but is that an explicit thing that you guys talk about and feel like is important?
We do, actually. About a third of the list ended up being was women, and we tried to, you know, make it, like I said before, geographically diverse, cuisines, male, female, and yes, it's something
ethnicity?
We do. Yes,
is ethnicity
yes,
into that
definitely. And we talked about it when we were first putting names down on the list. So,
do you feel like this is a generational thing? I mean, it's a relatively young crew at Tasting Table. Do you feel like some of this, like, do you feel? I don't want to name the name, but a friend of mine recently got it switched from one site to another.
Sure.
Sent a letter, an email out saying, you know, inviting people to pitch them stories and all mm-hmm. this, writers, mm-hmm. and said, you know, bonus points for non-white chefs,
sure.
right? And I thought, wow, you know, that's cool. That's great,
right.
you know? But I don't think I would have seen that even 10, 12 years ago.
True, and I think, you know, a lot of this younger generation are looking to their contemporaries and, you know, not the big names and the up-and-coming chefs tend to be, you know, a little bit more diverse and different voices and different cooking styles. So I think they're just relating to what, you know, their peers are doing as well in terms of age.
Right.
Seems like a real sign of progress. I know when I was thinking about how do we get into this topic in an interesting way, I was looking at the, you know, Oscars So White hashtag, the like kind of conversation around diversity in the Oscars, which is a, you know, institution that's been running much longer and is still dealing with these issues in the same way that, you know, newer awards are. I think it's something you have to be intentional about. I also think it's really important. I know, Elena, when I was looking at your bio, you know, obviously like awards and accolades in any chefs, like those are things that are at the very top of what people, you're not taught when I get a bio for a chef, it's not, oh, I made this great dish. It's like what other people have recognized my work. And I guess I'm just wondering like where you might jump in on the importance of awards and kind of how you've approached it.
I don't think awards or, acknowledgement is the most important sign of success. I think it is a part of success and it's a fun part of success, but success in the kitchen is defined in so many different ways. Does my souffle rise? That's success for today. I think it's a good thing. Titles, awards, they're important, but they are definitely not the most important thing. Hiring a team, teaching, making sure the restaurant is successful, making sure my team is successful. That's my day-to-day. And a lot of times you just don't have time to think about the other sort of bonuses of a kitchen.
Do you think that's gendered? Do you think that male chefs are thinking about it the same way you are?
I think the good ones are. I think that if you're focused on the kitchen, then you're probably a pretty successful chef.
Yeah.
If you're focused on your team, if you're focused on what you do and sort of the passion, then you're probably a pretty successful chef. Awards are bonuses.
I mean, any of the chefs here should feel free to jump in on this, but it sounds like such almost a cliched observation, but more than one person said it to me. You know, I did a book a couple of years ago about the Bocuse d'Or competition, and there's almost no women who compete in the Bocuse d'Or. Almost none. Like, really, almost none, historically, over 30 years. Very, very few. And I asked some women chefs I knew about it, and they said, you know, it's competitive enough for us to get what we want in our careers. We don't need to do that also. Does that resonate with any of you?
Very much.
How so, Cindy? I mean, you came up at a time when things were way less, you and I have talked about this privately, but way less evolved than they are now.
Well, to me, they're just, those kind of competition teams are such a boys' club. And I just kind of grew up in the phase where there was a lot of boys against girls in the kitchen and women in the kitchen, and it was very difficult. So I kind of distanced myself from anything that reminds me of that.
What does that mean? Like, how does that play out when you walk into the kitchen and you're talking about, like, boys against girls? Like, what does that look like?
Well, you know, when I started out, it was 100 million years ago, mind you. But, I mean, I could go work in the pantry or I could go work in the bake shop. And there was a lot of language that wasn't appropriate. I mean, it was just crazy compared to what I used to get calls on my days off and get yelled at because equipment had broken in the kitchen because there was women juice in the kitchen because I'd been there. I mean, it was just nutty stuff that would go on.
Wow. I'm wondering, Emma.
And I think, the CIA, you know, that great culinary school, rejected me because they'd filled their quota of women for the next 5 years. And I was welcome to reapply then.
5 years?
Yeah.
What?
It's like, great, 5 years. If I don't go to school for 5 years.
Was that in writing?
Profession.
Did they wrote you a letter that said that?
Yeah, I have a letter. I read it at one of their graduations when they asked me to come and speak. They were kind of mortified.
As they should be, and kudos to you for reading that. Emma, I'm wondering about for you. I mean, you've worked in kitchens in the U.S. You've worked in kitchens abroad. Like, how do you see a comparison, like, between, from, like, a more international perspective? Are you seeing this girls' club, boys' club situation play out differently in different parts of the world, or...?
I think definitely it's a huge difference, and I would say it's easier. It's not always easy, but it's easier in U.S. to be a female in the kitchen or a woman. In big parts of Europe, Sweden as well, it's still really, really hard. I'm part of a community of female chefs in Sweden, and the stories or people writing in for help, asking other female chefs, like, what should I do? I still can't find words sometimes for what guys do to women in the kitchen. It's degrading and it's bullying, and that it still exists, like, from when I was in the kitchen back home 10, 15 years ago. I could spend nights just crying over how badly treated I got, but that it still exists today, it's
shocking.
It's shocking.
Yeah,
like, I can't get over it.
Jimmy,
no, and it does still exist today. I know.
I'm wondering, Jimmy, as someone who is a chef, runs multiple restaurants, and is a guy, what do you see as, like, your responsibility for checking that behavior, setting that tone in the kitchen? How do you handle it when stuff like that comes up, or an employee comes to you and is like, hey, this is going down?
Well, you know, companies should define what's acceptable and what's unacceptable from the beginning, from the inception. I like to have women around me. I like to have women at the workplace around me. I like, you know, we have probably two people in each store that are the leaders of the store, and I like at least one of them to be a woman, and I like it to balance it out. They're going to approach and come at things differently, and I enjoy that aspect, and it also looks more like the real world, you know, diversity. You know, for me, it's just defining it right up front. And, you know, it's written in our manuals. It's part of the fabric of everything we do. This is acceptable. This is unacceptable. And it basically starts there. And then you have to reinforce it. You know, when you have women in leadership roles, it helps alleviate a lot of it. And when people can come to talk to people that are managers in your company and they feel comfortable with them, you know, we touched on this earlier, it creates a different environment for people to work in. So, you know, we work hard and we enjoy and we prefer only to work in a certain environment where things look and feel a certain way. And, you know, I mean, it does come from the top, but it also, it comes from every angle, you know. It has to do with who you hire at every level, and it has to do with how you share with them and how they share with you, and what your expectations are.
Yeah, I might ask you that same question, Emma, because when you move from being, a beginning line cook to a sous chef to a chef, those power dynamics change, And have you been, have you experienced gender differently as you've moved up the like ladder in the kitchen?
I think as of now, it's being in charge of the entire kitchen, I set the kitchen to where I want to have it.
Yeah.
So I do have a zero tolerance in the kitchen, and it's very clear from my point of view how it should be. We spend so much time there, and I think I'm almost like running my kitchen 50-50 women, men, and but going from different positions have a little bit harder. Like I know stepping up from a line cook into sous chef's positions or a chef position, it wasn't always as smooth, and there were people who couldn't really accept it. But I think the importance is to have people around you who support you and then grow from there, and you build your home, which is the kitchen is your home. You spend most of your days there, so so if you don't enjoy it and you don't feel comfortable and secure being there, I would never have it.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask one more question on this topic, and then we're going to shift gears a little bit. And Cindy, this is for you. I know for myself, when I was first getting into kitchens and coming up as a cook, I definitely experimented with, you know, acting in different ways. I would say, like, I was guilty of, like, inappropriate language or touching or, you know, pushing those boundaries. And I think in an effort to, I don't know, like, fit in, to figure out, like, how to be in the kitchen. And I'm curious, like, did you have kind of iterations where you're like, okay, I'm going to try like this, or maybe this will work better? Or was it always kind of pretty clear to you, like, what kind of line to toe?
Well, in the days when I was doing it, you had to be extremely tough, and you couldn't ask for help, and you couldn't ask for anything, because that would show a sign of weakness. And I just kind of put my head down and went through things. And just, I always kept telling myself, okay, you're going to take everything you can out of this person that you can learn from, and then you're going to get out of here, and you're going to create your own babies, and they're going to be nice places. So that was my little motivator. But I have a pretty bad potty mouth from all those years with those guys. I must say, I have to be very careful, because it just comes out. And, you know, it taught me how I wanted my places to be and how I wanted to treat my staff. And I think that's important, because as we've spoken about earlier, you set a core for the company, and then that's the way it behaves, and it's a wonderful environment. You know, we have men and women pretty much equal in all my kitchens in front of the houses, and on occasion we've had days where it's all, I've noticed where it's all, because of scheduling or whatever, it's all mostly one-sided, and it's not as smooth of a day as when you have a good balance in the kitchen or in the dining room.
Yeah, that's not a
surprise. So there is an interesting dynamic that you want males and females at the same time. It's not good to have just one or the other. Just because they get going in a direction.
Thank you.
It's harder to control. Either direction is harder to control.
Karen, just one thing before we go to break, because I am interested. Aaron, you mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, the whole Oscar thing mm-hmm. that came up, and there was kind of a little bit of blowback to that whole thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And a similar thing happened around the when the Beard semifinalist came out, and the blowback was, is it a failure of these awards committees or certain publications or whomever, you know, is bestowing these things? Is it a failure on their part, or are there fewer opportunities for in this case, women in this industry and in the other case, you know, black filmmakers or minority filmmakers, are there fewer opportunities for these people to rise to the top? And therefore, are these awards simply a reflection of an unfortunate reality that might exist? Karen, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because it's an interesting I don't even want to say counterpoint. It's an interesting gloss to put on the whole thing.
Right. Well, obviously, I don't have the answer, but...
Damn it!
I know, I'm sorry, guys.
We were going to solve some
really
shit today.
No, I actually... So, kind of tied to all this, I did an exercise with some of my editors yesterday. The majority of our work is done on staff and written by four female editors, mostly. So I asked them, without any context, to send me a list of the 5 to 10 most powerful and influential chefs in New York City, and then the 5 to 10 most talented. And it was really interesting how it came back, because I think there were, you know, on the list of most powerful, it was 29 men and like 3 women. And then the most talented balanced out a little bit. But I mean, I think it's all like, you know, this is how the industry is perceived, even from journalists who are trying to, you know, like I said, be inclusive and include a lot of different viewpoints. So, yeah, it's like, where does it start? And okay. how do we make it better?
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break. We are here talking with Karen Palmer, Alina Martel, Emma Benson, Cindy Paulson, and guest co-hosting with us today is Aaron Fairbanks. We're going to take a quick break, and The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew and Aaron will be back in just a minute.
Just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
Welcome back to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We are here today talking about several issues surrounding women in the pro kitchen. And our guests are Karen Palmer from Tasting Table, Emma Benson from Aquavit, Alina Martel, pastry chef of iFiori and Vaucluse, and Cindy Paulson of Mustard's Grill and Cindy's Backstreet Kitchen in St. Helena, California. And we are joined today by Executive Director of Heritage Radio Network, Aaron Fairbanks, who is co-hosting with us today. And Aaron, I'm going to turn it back over to you to get the conversation rolling again.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about babies. looking at you, Alina. There has been some interesting press coverage recently looking specifically at the issue of maternity leave and childcare, in particular in the restaurant community, but I think also just across all employment levels in the U.S. And I'm wondering, can you talk a little bit about your kind of decision to get pregnant and what were some of the factors that weighed in that decision?
Well, I'm not sure it's 100%. A decision. It sometimes just happens. I think that, you know, I'm at a point, very fortunately, in my career and in where I work, that there is a lot of people who do have families and are building families. There was an article written about women in the kitchen and in the industry, I think in 2013 in the New York Times, and it included a lot about Alta Maria Group, where I work. And one of the interesting quotes from our owner was that the kitchen has been historically a transient kind of industry. And I think that that is changing. And I think that it is becoming more professional, and that you can build a career and actually build a life and still work in the kitchen. And that is definitely a good thing, especially for women. And so I felt, and my husband, who also works for Alta Maria Group, that it was just a good time, a good age, a good time, and that's what we wanted to do. And I think that we didn't have any fear, and that's a really good thing. I'm fortunate, again, that I don't have fear that my job is going to be in jeopardy or that I can't come back and rejoin my team when that time comes.
How do you know that your job is going to be there?
I think it's the culture of where you work.
So it's not a written policy. You're trusting that, like, they're going to hold spot for you?
Well, there are laws. Okay. You know, there, of course, the FMLA requires that, you know, any employer who, if you've worked there for a year or they have more than 50 employees, that you are guaranteed your job or an equivalent job when you come back. That guarantees unpaid leave, but not, and it guarantees your job. So besides that is the law, and I fully expect that most companies would abide by the law. I know just by experience and how the company that I do work for treats its employees. And if there's an emergency, if there is a family crisis, if there is a medical, you know, or if there's an injury, how they've taken care of employees in the past. And so I fully expect that sort of generosity and care extends to almost everyone. So.
Yeah. I feel like one of the things that you hear from employers or comes up in this discussion a lot is that people are really afraid that women are going to take advantage of maternity leave policies or somehow use them as a way to kind of trick employers into paying them and like never coming back. I mean, how would you respond to that?
I think it's kind of funny, mostly because working in a kitchen while being pregnant is not really something where you're in a situation where you're like, you know what? This is really easy. This is good. You know, we opened Vaucluse and I was in my first trimester. So, you know, that's not easy. I don't think any woman would be like, yeah, I'm going to do that because that sounds like an easy life. That's not even reasonable. But I don't see how you would take advantage. I mean, I only know from my perspective, you know, I fully want, my desire is to come back. I don't have a roadmap. I wish I had a perfect plan. I don't know exactly how it will work when I come back. You know, I look around the industry and I don't know any women, female chefs, who have children, who don't own their own businesses, and continue to work. I don't know anybody. I wish I did because I would like to talk to them and see how they did it.
Yeah, call us.
But I don't have a roadmap. So it's going to be figuring things out as we go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Cindy, as someone who, you know, is at the helm of organizations, how do you think about designing a maternity policy? Do you have one? Have you tried different things in the past?
Well, we do have one. You know, there's very clear laws in California, and we're a pretty, I mean, I think of us as a caring company, and we've had many people in front and back of the house that have gone off on maternity leave and come back. Sometimes they come back in a different way. They don't want full time or they want to work, you know, in a different position, but that's up to them. I've let them, you know, my biggest fear, and it's happened a couple times, is that they're at work too far into their pregnancies, and I'm always really nervous. I've had two women have their water break right in the kitchen. It's like, God, no, we got to get you to the hospital. You know, and it's like, no, you should have taken a week off earlier, you know, but they're hardworking, fun people. So that's the scary part to me, but they've often come back. They've all come back except for one that I can think of that decided she just wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. But that was up to her, you know, and she had the financial wherewithal to do that.
Well,
but several of them have come back full-time and then switched to part-time or come back part-time. And then as the child matures, they go back into full-time. I've had no problems, really. But it's a very individual thing. It depends on the person.
You mentioned that California has, you know, a built-in family leave policy. Can you tell us how that works for you as an employer? What are you kind of required to do? And, you know, what's the cost to you of providing that benefit?
Boy, I wish I was the HR cap
sorry,
that I'm not wearing right now. But you give a certain amount of time prior to the birth. And then I think it's 8 weeks after, either 6 or 8 weeks after. And we cover their insurance and all that, you know, just kind of send them food and make sure they're taken care of and do all that kind of fun. That's not by law. That's just by who we are.
Right, right.
It's not inexpensive, but it's just something you don't question. It's what you do to be a good person. You know, that's the minimum of what you can do.
Yeah,
with someone, and we try to go over and above that because our our people work so hard and they're so great to us.
It's, I feel like it's a real fantastic kind of national issue in the U.S. I mean, we're one of the very few countries in the entire world that doesn't offer a paid maternity policy as a matter of course. I'm wondering to the two other women who I'm assuming are childless. I'm getting nods. You know, how does this issue fall into any type of a priority for you, Emma, when you're thinking about what type of organization you want to be a part of or what seems like fair and right to you? Do you have worries or concerns about your line cooks or folks coming to you and having to kind of deal with this? Have you dealt with it?
I'm still trying to figure out the American way a little. I'm coming from a country where you get a year paid.
Hold on. So. Can you say that one more time? You get a year of paid maternity leave.
And they actually recently put down that the man or the guy have to take 6 months. So the woman gets six and the guy gets six as well, just to make it equal. So having that always in the back of your mind, and I have not women who have birth in my restaurant, but I have two guys who just became fathers, and having the talk with them and figure out what they wanted to do. One of my sous chef, I actually just gave 2 months a father's leave because he wanted to stay home with his kids so the mom could go back to work. And I think it's the right thing to do. It's just who you should be as a human person. Like, if you have a child and you want to be with them, your job should always be there when you come back. You should never have to feel like you're sacrificing your career for your kid, because there's no choice there. You should always choose the kid if that's the case. So it's just a given thing. It should be there.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I mean, I think about for an organization like Heritage Radio Network, we don't have a maternity policy in place. It's not something that we've ever kind of had to tackle. But when I think about I feel like we echo many of the concerns I hear from other small business owners. I'm like, oh, we're so tiny. Everyone's so integral. I think you read, quotes from chefs and restaurateurs who are like, oh, you know, this type of small business is different and we don't know how to do it. I'm wondering, Jimmy, if you could talk a little bit about what would make offering a more generous maternity or paternity program easier for you as a small business owner? I mean, if you could kind of, you know, blank slate it, like, what are the tools you need from a kind of financial time management skill set to make that something that really works for your businesses?
Right. It's such a sliding scale. You never know. I mean, there's, if you have a small business, and like other things in life, and you're around for a long time, you're going to experience times where you make good money, and you're going to experience times when you make absolutely no money. You know, it's a fact of life. It's just how it goes.
Very true.
I really think that, you know, what Emma said was right on. Like, we should come together and support this in a certain way. You know, what would be the case if you couldn't make somebody else's salary to afford to pay somebody's salary who wasn't working? You know, there's a lot of catch-22s in there. It might go back to, you know, pretty sure there's no silver bullet in this conversation, but, you know, this evil socialized word, socialism and perhaps socialized medicine and also political will. You know, we had a choice to do something that would be like a single payer system that we don't have the political will to get through. So my point about, you know, perhaps other ways to handle this is some sort of subsidies from the government or health care policies, you know, like a disability type policy where someone could get paid for not being at work. You pay in a policy maybe $500 to $3,000 a year, and you take out, you know, $500 to $3,000 a week for however long you're out. So
right.
there's probably lots of different ways that we're not really talking about because of, you know, political will or capitalism and how those two things in America might not be ideal right now. Or certain they're not how our founders envisioned them.
And it shouldn't be, sorry to jump in, I don't want to interrupt.
No, it's good. Thank you for that. We were waiting for an interruption.
You know, it shouldn't be the burden of a small business in any industry. The restaurant industry in particular, the margins are slim.
Right.
And they're getting smaller.
Right. We buy and sell things that go bad. It's us and the florist that are the two craziest people. And like, hey, I want to do that because I know I can't make any money and I'll work all day and all night.
And it shouldn't be the sole responsibility of a small business, especially a small, maybe, you know, 20-person restaurant.
Right.
There is actually some government movement in the state of New York. There is a bill in a committee in the Senate where that would allow sort of the California style of what the state will pay an expanded temporary disability insurance. So right now, because I have some information because I've been looking into this, right now when I go on maternity leave, I could file for disability insurance and I get a whopping $170 a week in New York City. That would buy what, diapers? I don't know.
Maybe.
But
Metro card.
Yeah, possibly
cigarettes.
A Metro card. it is in committee right now. This the governor called for it in his State of the State address, and it would expand the TDI to about $600 a week, capped, or 2/3 of your salary. So I'm sure that would help.
Yeah,
and it would definitely help the restaurant industry.
And there's a again for the interruption. Apologies. You know, we're running out of time, and just want to get something in the sense that, you know, big business versus small business. You know, you turn on the TV in this political cycle. Small business is the engine that runs America. Yet everything we're doing in America is subsidizing and rewarding big business, which, you know, unfortunately pushes small business out. You know.
Well, so before we one of the things that irks me about this conversation is it's so often directed at women as a woman's issue, which is bananas, because no woman in the history of the world has ever created a child by herself. And I think, Emma, it's like so interesting that you were in a position to have a conversation with some of your male cooks and chefs talking about the importance of them having the space and time. And I'm wondering, Andrew, you know, you're a dad. Why do you think that men are not stepping up a little bit more to say like, hey, this is my issue too, and I want some time off because it's important that I'm with my kids in the same way their mom is?
Yeah, I mean, as the writer in my family, it's hard for me to answer that because when we were trying to get pregnant however you want to phrase that, you know, I started planning for that, optimistically planning for what we thought would be the timing, and I took 6 months off. I mean, I did a lot of work the year before our twins were born, and then when they were born, I didn't work for 6 months, and then I co-wrote Jimmy's book. I was already kind of there. But I, you know, I'll answer this another way, which is, you know, I feel like this topic, and I do think it's probably easier for, I've spoken to people, we were getting ready to do the show, friends of mine who have worked for large restaurant companies, and they talked about, you know, someone took maternity leave, and, you know, they can move people around, you know, in much smaller restaurants, like a lot of restaurants near where we're sitting here in Brooklyn. You know, I don't know how those people, just on a practical level, fill a position, you know, for a fixed amount of time, how they find that person who's going to take that job and commit to that. But I think there's a larger issue to me, which is, you know, this business, I think, that the chefs here are in has always been sort of accepted as sort of a relationship killer. You know, it's always been seen as, forget parenthood. I mean, it's always been seen as a job that does not lend it. I mean, all the cooks here are laughing, right? But it's not a profession that has traditionally lent itself to even having a boyfriend or having a girlfriend. I mean, that has just been an accepted fact of life. So to me, this conversation sort of leapfrogs that conversation. Like, that, there's a whole bigger thing. And I think we are at an interesting time right now in the professional cooking trade, because I think there a lot of things are changing. People are looking at hours and wages and how people behave in a kitchen. And, you know, we've had Kat Kinsman on the show, who's kind of raising this awareness of this thing that's really existed forever, but, you know, of mental health in the kitchen and stress and all, everything connected to that. I don't feel like these things all happening at the same time as a coincidence. I think we had Paul Liebrand on the show a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, in society, things have gotten a lot better over the, you know, periodically they get a lot better. But in this industry, the last 10, 15 years have been a period of enormous evolution and enlightenment and growth around a lot of different, just how you look at the human side of the people in the job, right? So I think that's all part of a, does that make sense? It's all part of a larger conversation to me. I don't look at it in isolation. And I know a lot of chefs who are fathers who, you know, honestly, I don't even think they perceive the question. You know, I think it's just been such a given that if you work in a kitchen and you become a dad, like, you're just not going to be around as much as you might like to. I don't think it even occurs. It's so ingrained, you know, maybe not in someone who's like 18 and just getting out of the CIA now and coming up. But I think for people, you know, late 20s or older, that you're, that's been the kind of role model, for lack of a better term, of what a chef is. Like, you sacrifice and you're not around and you're not there on Christmas or Thanksgiving and you're only home, you know, and I think that's just what people assume the business is. So I think there's this kind of mental wall. I think it's a great and obvious question, but I don't think it's there for the asking for a lot of people. I just think it's not... they don't perceive that question. They wouldn't even think to ask it. It's just the norm. It's just the norm. It's almost like the culinary equivalent of the dad in like a 50s situation, you know, who comes home exhausted and give me my martini and my, you know, pipe, and I gotta go decompress and read the paper. I mean, it's kind of the culinary equivalent of that. I don't think it's evolved much beyond that.
I was just going to say, I think it, when I was thinking about maternity leave and why it might be important, is there's another industry or another issue in the industry that's come up in the media a lot as well, and that's keeping and finding talented staff.
Oh, yeah.
And an industry that relies on talent so much. There are other industries like that. The restaurant industry is one of them. And that's really a genderless issue. You know, how do you keep your good staff? How do you find talented cooks? And maybe paid maternity leave, maybe something like that, or those sort of benefits help the restaurant industry eventually keep that talent. And, you know, we haven't reached that tipping point where it's essential as a benefit package, but perhaps we'll get to that point, because finding and keeping talent is increasingly difficult.
I know one thing that we do in our restaurants that's helped tremendously in the last 3 years is that we have extra people now. We have what we call MITs, and that helps cover the management. They're younger people that are younger in the industry. They can be any age, but they're learning the business, and they kind of do a little bit of every job, and that allows us flexibility in our scheduling. So if somebody's kid has a baseball game, or somebody's, you know, you know, a kid has a dance thing they have to do, they can, there's more flexibility in our schedules, and that's helped morale a lot, and it's helped everybody have a more civilized life. But it's added to the overall cost of the business to, you have to make that decision if you can afford it.
Yeah, you prioritize different things. Well, sadly, we're about out of time. I just want to say, I feel like one of the things that's been really resonating for me hearing from everyone in the room today is the importance and the value of having women, and you said this earlier, Jimmy, women in leadership roles in your organization, because having somebody in that space, driving these conversations, asking those questions, in a lot of ways, that's really the starting point, is having somebody kind of checking the industry in that way. So I think, great job, guys.
Yeah, it's been a really good show. I'd love to. I'm going to I'm going to make a recommended reading suggestion to people, because both in talking to Aaron and Jimmy before the show today, I said to Jimmy jokingly, but it's proved to be true, I said, don't interrupt on this show, Jimmy. There will be no interrupting by our guests. And the reason was, I'd gone to, I was one of the few guys in attendance at the Cherry Bomb Jubilee last year. And, you know, after about an hour, I turned to the friend who I went with and I said, you know, nobody has interrupted anybody on these panels the entire time. Not once. Not once. And it reminded me of this book I read years ago called, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation by Deborah Tannen. It was a huge bestseller at the time, and this whole conversation and prepping for the show reminded me what an amazing book that is, and I'd recommend it to anyone listening to this, because there are real differences in how men and women communicate and how they function in a workplace, and they're all tackled in that book, and I think it's a really valuable thing. We are very much out of time. We have another show coming in right behind us, and we got to make some room. So with that, I'd like, first of all, thank you, Aaron Fairbanks, for co-hosting with us today. And thanks to our guests, Karen Palmer, Emma Benson, Alina Martel, Cindy Paulson. Thank you very much for phoning in.
Thanks.
Great to hear
thanks
your voice.
Me.
And with that, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we'll see you back next week on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.